Welcome to the Central Assembly Podcast. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
As we continue our series on the Minor Prophets, major lessons from the Minor Prophets. The Minor Prophets are the short prophets. And we come today to Obadiah, who is actually, Obadiah is only one chapter long. That's why we'll say things like Obadiah 3, Obadiah 4. Those aren't chapters, those are just verses because there's only one chapter. And it is the shortest book in the Old Testament. And we call them minor prophets because they're short-winded, as opposed to the major prophets that are chapters and chapters and chapters long. They're short. I can't say this will be the shortest sermon you've ever heard. Sorry to disappoint you, but they're short. I did really appreciate. We've had two weather interruptions this past month and a half already. We've had to cancel two Sundays, so we got our order all mixed up. George Paul did a fantastic job last week doing Micah. I had assigned him Micah 2 months ago, and so it would have been in sequence, but now having missed two Sundays due to weather, we're out of sequence. So I'm doing Obadiah this week, and I'll do Jonah next week, and then Nahum. And so that's where we're going to be going, Lord willing. Praise God. May we not have any more snow and ice storms on Sunday. In the name of the Lord. And we're going to talk about pride's downfall. Pride is absolutely, it's the most toxic thing I know to our spiritual life. It is the very thing that fueled the devil's rebellion against God. Satan himself at his core can be defined by the DNA of pride. And Obadiah is all about pride's downfall. In verse 1 of Obadiah, we're introduced to him. His word simply means the servant of the Lord. And the vision that he had, the vision of Obadiah, Obadiah 1:1, the vision of Obadiah, this is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. Now, the land of Edom was located in an area south of the Dead Sea. The Edomites were cousins of the Israelites. But rather than being kissing cousins, they were killing cousins. They hated each other. You remember Isaac had two sons. They were twins. His wife had twins, right? And they were Esau and Jacob. And the Edomites were descendants of Esau. Jacob, his name was changed to Israel, and his descendants were the Israelites. Well, it turns out that this prophecy through Obadiah comes against the descendants of Esau, the Edomites, for the way in which they cheered on the enemies that destroyed Jerusalem, probably the Babylonians that destroyed Jerusalem in the 6th century BC. They weren't grieving over, they weren't coming to the defense of their cousins. They were cheering on and even aiding and abetting the enemy against the Israelites. And so God's got something to say to them. What's interesting about the land of Edom, where the Edomites settled, it's some of you have visited there. If you visited the country of Jordan and gone to one of what some consider one of the seven wonders of the world, the city of Petra. Here's a picture of Petra right here. I took this while I was there. I've been there three or four times in the last few years. And think Indiana Jones. That's a scene out of, I think, the third Indiana Jones movie. You can see people. I took this picture intentionally with people in the foreground to see how huge it is. It's a city. It's kind of a pink-colored city that is a pink rock, and it's a city carved out of the rock. And that's a picture of the treasury building, which is really a tomb. And that's what you see when you first come in through these narrow channels. It's got huge mountains all around. It's very well defended. The next picture, you can see it's kind of a city that's carved out of stone. It's carved out of the rock. And the next picture shows us how that it's surrounded by these tall, jagged mountains that surround. And so, when you visit Petra, you can kind of visit the valley floor, but it's not really spacious. It's just full of these jagged mountains all around. So they actually build the city into the rock. So with that in mind, look with me at Obadiah verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you, God says. You who, look at this, live in the clefts of the rocks. live in places carved right out of the rocks, and make your home on the heights, all these heights. It's just cities carved into the rock and these heights. This is like living text. This describes precisely what we know to be the geography of the Edomites, where the present, where the ruins of Petra lie. And the issue is pride. The pride of your heart has deceived you. Pride will always lie to you. It will always tell you you're better than you really are. And pride will always tell you that other people are worse than they really are. Pride never lets you see life objectively. Pride always, even beyond how you look at yourself and how you look at others, pride always distorts the role of God in your life and how you view Him. And he says, the pride of your heart has deceived you. It's lied to you, as pride always does. You live in the clefts of the rock. You make your home on the heights. You say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? Because the Edomites felt like they were rather invincible because, I mean, they were so secure. Just the geography of the land made it so tough for enemies to come in and conquer them. And how do you knock down houses that are carved out of rocks? You know, I mean, they just had this myth that they were secure, and they were proud about it, and they felt like they were invincible. And he said, I'm going to bring you down. So the next picture is a picture of my wife on a donkey. Now, 2 years ago, we were in Petra, and we decided to go from the valley floor, where the ruins of Petra are when you enter, and go to the top. See the mountains behind her? Well, kind of in front of her, there's the same kind of mountains. We thought, we will actually go to the top. And one of the ways is to hike, the other way is to take a donkey. And so I was on another donkey behind her, and it was the scariest thing we have done in years. I mean, it was, because it's steep. I mean, it's so steep, and that donkey's like at an angle like this, and you're trying to stay on the little saddle there. And it's a very rocky path, and it's straight up, and then it winds, and it's straight up, and to your right is nothing but sheer cliffs. And you're going, if that donkey was to stumble on one of those loose rocks on the path just ahead of me, like, it's lights out. I mean, literally, we were terrified. I mean, it was like the scare. I'm not kidding you. It was the scariest thing we've done in years, and probably the stupidest. I was thinking, I got credential cards to sign. I've got, you know, I mean, and I'm throwing my life away just to say I went to the top from where the Edomites said you could never bring us down. Well, you had to come down, and you come down on the donkey, but it was so steep coming down, we had to get off the donkey for a while and walk part of the way. Well, I was there a year later, and this time I hiked up, and I hiked up with Wave Nunley, who's standing there on the left, who teaches one of our classes and professor at Evangel University. In fact, I just got back yesterday from a tour of Israel with Wave Nunley. I traveled with him. He's a fantastic guide. I call him the Indiana Jones of the Assemblies of God. And I'm the short guy just to his left. And we went up, and Wave hiked us up to the top, to what are called the heights, the places where Obadiah will go on to say the eagles nest. And up near the stars. See, this is the, and you can see the terrain all behind us. This rocky, rugged, spiring mountains all around that gave them this sense of invincibility and this sense that nothing can take me down. And so we went up there. Actually, Wave did a Bible study on Obadiah sitting on top and reading this text and pointing out the geographic features that were exactly as Obadiah describes them all the way around us. In fact, let's look at that next verse, verse 4. Though you soar like the eagle, God says to the Edomites through Obadiah, though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, speaking of those jagged heights all around them, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Because your pride has deceived you. One of the major prophets also did some of his preaching against the Edomites, and that was Isaiah. And in Isaiah 2, just insert this from outside of Obadiah. In Isaiah chapter 2, verse 12, the Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. For the arrogance, verse 17 of Isaiah 2, the arrogance of man will be brought low, and human pride humbled. For the Lord alone will be exalted in that day, and the idols will totally disappear. This is God's agenda globally. There will come a day when Christ comes again, that everything proud and arrogant and exalted and self-secure outside of God will be brought down. Now, you were exhorted in the video that if you think you're a super singer, humble yourself and join the choir. But there will come a day when God says, I have a day in store for all the proud and the lofty, for all that's exalted, and the arrogance of man will be brought low, and human pride will be humble. That's God's global agenda. And he's saying to Edom, that's going to happen to you in a very specific way. Because of your pride and the way you aided and abetted the enemy against my people, thinking that you were invincible, thinking that your security had no breaches in it, I know how to bring down the most confident. I know how to bring down the arrogant. I know how to bring down the most self-assured. And I want to tell you, I believe every one of us has a vulnerability. God knows how to humble every one of us. Before the global time comes, I just believe, you know, whenever I start feeling cocky, whenever I start feeling like, hey, I'm some kind of event, you know, I'm some kind of important person, I want to tell you, the God who said to the world in Isaiah 2, I will bring down the arrogant and the lowly. I want you to know, God knows exactly what it takes to humble Jim Bradford. He knows exactly what it takes to humble you. And he'll do it if he has to. He'll do it if he has to. Because there's few things that are more poisonous to our spiritual life than feeling arrogant and self-sufficient, when we ought to be feeling dependent on God and grateful for every day that he gives us. Where we don't feel like I'm some kind of self-made person, but God, I'm yours, and I'm your creation, and I'm depending on you, and I'm going to live this life humbly. The problem with humility is, how do you know if you are humble? Right? Like the guy who said, I'm humble and proud of it. And I hate to say this, if you think you're a humble person, you're probably not, just by the very fact you think you're humble. I mean, this thing of humility and pride is the hardest thing in the world to get our hands around. I mean, how do we even know? And the fact is, you don't know for sure. All I know is that God, if you stay open to him, he knows how to keep you humble in ways he understands it. But what I love about Obadiah is he gets away from our Western 21st century thing to define pride and humility as an emotional condition. And instead, he deals with pride from a behavioral point of view. He said, here are the behaviors that indicate you're a proud person. Here are the behaviors. Now, I can get around behaviors much easier than I can get around emotions. I mean, who knows how in line my emotions are with reality. But he gives us now, Obadiah gives us three symptoms of the Edomite's pride. These are three behavioral symptoms of pride. There are more than three out there, but these are the three that Edom was guilty of, and they're enough for one day. I mean, they're enough to keep us busy for some time. And first of all, he says, pride behaviorally will refuse to get involved when others are hurting. For verse 11, he really starts coming at him, speaking of when Jerusalem was under siege from the Babylonians. He said, on that day, you stood aloof. You just kept your distance. You just refused to get involved. You stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem. You were like one of them. In fact, he is saying here that your aloofness makes you as bad as those who did the damage themselves. One of the great, to me, spiritual heroes of the 20th century was Billy Graham, and he, of course, passed away. He was known for his humility. but he was not known for standing aloof. He didn't stand aloof from presidents and speaking truth to power. He didn't stand aloof from millions of people that needed Christ, who maybe did not want to hear the gospel, but he didn't stand aloof. And he was a very, very humble man. Another hero of the 20th century, spiritually, was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who lived during the time and died just before World War II was over. During the late 1930s, he was a wonderful theologian. He was just a young man, brilliant for a young man. The stuff he wrote at 22, 23, 24 years old was staggering. He wrote from prison books like The Cost of Discipleship. He was an ardent follower of Jesus Christ, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and a humble man. And at one point, as Hitler was gaining power in Germany, he was German himself, he was forced to flee to London. And while he was in London, he had a choice that few people would want to make. He could either go and get the dream job teaching at Union Seminary in New York City, or he could go back to Germany and lead an underground seminary for churches that were choosing to resist Hitler's power and the growth of the Nazis. And I love how Scott Higgins put it. Dietrich Bonhoeffer decided his faith is meaningless if he takes the easy option. You know, and who do we think we are to say, I'm taking the easy option? How does our faith let us take the easy option? How do we get so self-preoccupied and so self-fixated that our main mission in life is to protect ourselves? That's where arrogance takes you. That's where pride takes you. It will keep you away. You just look at an average week in your life. I mean, what are you doing to make your faith really mean something when it comes to getting your hands involved in things that are messy and that are going to complicate your life and going to cost you something, versus the ease with which we could just stay aloof and rationalize it's all okay, but I'm something, and I'm just kind of living above the trouble everybody else has. That's one of the behavioral symptoms of pride in Obadiah. They stayed aloof at the very moment they should have gotten involved. Secondly, Obadiah says pride also delights when others fall. You just gloat when people you don't like get what you think's coming to them. And so in verse 12, he said, God says to the Edomites, you should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune. Remember, God said it's pride that's deceived you. And what does pride make you do? It makes you gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune. Nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. Now, I don't think he's talking about sports here. You know, when I was a young kid, I lived in Toronto, Canada, and I was in Canada, hockey's the other religion, right? So I was like a Toronto Maple Leafs fan. My uncle used to take me to Leaf games, and it was the competition of all competitions when the Montreal Canadiens came to Toronto to play the Maple Leafs. And I remember how I used to gloat whenever the Leafs beat the Canadiens. It was some. But he's not talking about sports. Probably okay to gloat over that kind of thing. But sometimes I say to pastors when I'm traveling and doing leadership things, I'll say to pastors, what are you going to do when your biggest critic in the church lands up in the hospital and you're the only one available to visit them? You walk in there and go, God got you, huh? I knew he would eventually. Just feels so good to see me up and you down when you thought it was opposite. I want to tell you, especially with people, especially with the guy who's giving you an awful time at the office, and then he's the one who loses his job and you get promoted, it's pretty easy to think they got what they deserved. You know, and it's easy to gloat. You know what? God traces that back to our wicked old hearts, though, and said, that's just pride. That's not how I look at people. That you would gloat when somebody who you think deserves it anyway just gets what you think's coming to them. See, you don't gloat. You don't gloat when somebody, and the opposite happens too, when the guy is causing you the hard time, you know, when he gets the promotion and you don't. I mean, what happens in your heart? That'll eventually get right back to the degree to which pride has been tamed inside of you. And so pride keeps you from getting involved. Pride makes you gloat. It delights over the misfortune of others. It delights when others fall. And he's not quite done with us yet. Pride also benefits at others' expense. Pride doesn't care. If you're a proudful person, you don't care how other people feel as long as you get what you want. And so in verse 13, the next verse, he says, in Obadiah, you should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. Verse 14, you should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. In other words, when they were down, they actually exploited them. Here are the Israelites, they're running from Jerusalem. Jerusalem's being demolished. The temple's being destroyed. All their hopes and dreams are being shattered. First of all, they stayed aloof. They didn't get involved. That's partly why their pride deceived them. That's partly the behavioral evidence that their pride had deceived them. Secondly, they were gloating. They weren't feeling bad for their cousins. They were gloating over the destruction of Jerusalem. And then, on top of it, they went in and they took advantage of them in their weakness and they seized their wealth in the days of the dead. They went in and helped take the plunder for themselves. The Babylonians knocked them down and they went and took the plunder for themselves. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives. People were running. They had no defense. They were running for their lives and you took advantage of them and you beat them and you robbed them and you took for yourself when they were in a disadvantaged place. Nor should you hand over their survivors in the day of trouble to get paid off. You benefited at their expense when they were down. I talked to somebody, a young lady who works for a company, an organization in another state, and she said, you know, I got this boss, my supervisor. She just said to me, I think I work in a very dysfunctional organization because nobody wants to take responsibility. And I had a guy do something that really affected me and my team negatively. And then he wrote my superiors and said, well, I had given permission to do it. He effectively threw me under the bus to make himself look good. I mean, that's a bad feeling. That's what happens in unhealthy organizations. We don't take responsibility. We just throw people under the bus to make us look good. If you've been a victim of physical abuse or sexual abuse, you know to the core of your being what it feels like for somebody to exploit you and benefit to feed their personal lust and greed at your expense and without your permission. And I believe in influence in relationships. We're all trying to influence one another well. But you can cross a line into manipulation where you just are getting people to do things they normally wouldn't choose to, and you're not doing it for their benefit, you're doing it for your benefit. You're doing because you need, because you want, and therefore you expect everybody else to meet your expectations. If that isn't the definition of arrogance, the epitome of arrogance, I don't know what is. I mean, who do we think we are that everybody in our world meets our expectations? I mean, who do we think we are? And benefiting at other people's expense, rather than the lens of Jesus, which would be concerned about not using people just to benefit yourself, but concerned about lifting people up around you. I tell you, you want to be a person of godly influence, you're lifting everybody up around you. You're trying to make every place you are, every social setting, every organization you work, you're trying to leave them better than when you first came because you're lifting people up. You're not just manipulating and exploiting and using people for your own benefit. And if you've been a victim of that, you know, you felt the pain of arrogant people who can't see past just using the people around them for their own benefit. The trap you might fall into if you're a victim is you start thinking like a victim and you start acting like a victim yourself, even though other people have victimized you. You can't ever go there. You are not a slave to what other people do to you. I'm going to say that one more time because I only saw one person nod his head, yes. Okay. You are not a slave to what other people have done for you. That's why, in fact, Jesus asks us to forgive people if you've been victimized. You know, and you need to call them to account. You need to draw a line. You need to say no, no more of this. But the fact is, don't let yourself, if you've been victimized by people who've used you for their own expense, for their own benefit, don't ever let that dominate your life. In Jesus, you are free. Part of forgiveness means I am not going to let your past behavior affect my present. When you forgive somebody, you are declaring your freedom in the present from all the pain in the past. And then it puts you in a position to work through that pain and have difficult conversations with people if you need to. But here's what pride, unchecked, unbridled arrogance does in people's lives. It keeps them away when others are in trouble. And it makes them gloat over other people's demise. And it makes people want to keep victimizing other people for their own personal gain. And I want to tell you, God has that in his sights. He keeps track of all that. And there's a day he's going to call every victimizer to account. Listen, you may not be in a position to get even, but God is a God of justice. When it comes to God, I'm afraid fairness doesn't work very well to describe him, at least in this life. But justice always describes him. And that's why he said, I have a day for all the pride and the arrogant. He says, in Psalm 10, he said, I take the victim in hand. I know what the victim's feeling. I take on that mission myself, and I know. And say, well, if I forgive a victimizer, am I just, and I'm rambling. This isn't even my notes right now, but I just feel this strongly in this moment. If I forgive victimizers, then I'm just letting them off the hook. And I go, no, you're not letting them off the hook. You're just taking them off your hook and putting them on God's hook. And I want to tell you, God's got a pretty big hook. God's a God of justice. God knows how to watch out for you. And life may not be fair, and you may not be avoid. You can't avoid. In our arrogant world, you can't avoid people who will throw you under the bus just to get their way and make themselves look good. You can't avoid victimizers in your life. But I want to tell you, in Jesus, you can walk free of how other people have treated you. You can have a starting point for a new life to live. You cannot let their victimizing of you dominate your psyche and dominate your spirit and dominate your choices. Listen, your choices in the future can be made not because of your pain, not because of somebody else, but because of what Jesus is doing in your life. Wait, what it'd be like to live that way? My choices aren't determined by my pain. My choices are determined by my values and by the call of God in my life. This is freedom. This is how God can bring us. And so he comes raging at Edom. He said, at the moment of my people's vulnerability, you stood aloof, you gloated over their destruction, and you benefited at their expense. Those are the three behavioral symptoms of pride that God just nails them for. And then he talks about pride's payday. Verse 15, for the day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. And your deeds will return upon your own head. Now, I was convicted when I read that verse again this week. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. You know, that's a principle that goes through all life. You reap what you sow, right? And because there is a God, I may be powerless to make people change the way they treat me. But here it is. He says to the Edomites, although all these injustices are already in the past, God says, I haven't forgotten. And as you've done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. As many of you know, I keep my Bible app on my phone. I bookmark scriptures. And I realize, you know, I bookmark scriptures that are promises that make me feel good. That, you know, and I love that. I sometimes quote these scriptures when I'm praying. God, you said you'd do this. But that's not a scripture I ever bookmarked till this week. I bookmarked that scripture. So I said, I you know what? That's part of what I need to keep in front of me. As I've done, it's going to be done to me. Yes. And it wouldn't hurt me to keep reminding myself of that. when I go through my bookmark scriptures and meditate on them. As it's done to you, it will be done to you. As you have done, it will be done to you, and your deeds will return upon your old head. That ought to put the fear of God in us. You know what? That's part of the Bible. So I decided I'm going to keep reminding myself of that. The principle in reverse is found in 1 Peter 5, verse 6. This is the reverse. On the other hand, humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. We exalt ourselves, he's going to bring us down. But I want to tell you, we humble ourselves. He has a way of lifting us up. He has a way of getting even where we can't get even, or possibly even shouldn't get even. He has a way of protecting our reputation when there's sometimes nothing we can do, even though we've only done what's right. He has a way, when we humble ourselves under his mighty hand, to lift us up. The question is, how do we do that? Here's my favorite quote on pride. It was written by Philip Brooks. I put it in a box in your notes. The true way to be humble, is not to stoop until you are smaller than yourself, but to stand at your real height against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is. When Peter said, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, sometimes I've felt in the past that means, you know, just put myself down until I feel awful about myself. I'm not really humble. Now, I love what he says. The true way to be humble is not to stoop until you're smaller than who you really are. Just be who you are. Don't be more than what you are. But to stand at your real height. But don't get too impressed. And the thing that keeps you from getting too impressed is that you stand at your full height. You don't grovel. You don't beat yourself up. You don't constantly criticize yourself. You don't feel guilty when you feel good about yourself in an appropriate way. That's not humility. But true humility is standing against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is. It's perspective. And that greater one, that higher one, is Jesus. See, he talks about another mountain in the end of Obadiah 17, and it's a mountain of salvation, and it's a mountain of deliverance. He says, but on Mount Zion, that would be where Jerusalem is. He just talked about the destruction of Jerusalem and how they gloated, how they stood aloof, refused to help, and how they even, as people were running for their lives, they exploited them unfairly to their own advantage. He says, but on Mount Zion will be deliverance. See, that's always God's final word. And it will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. It'll be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. And verse 21, and deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, and the king and the kingdom will be the Lord's. See, there's another mountain. He said, the mountains of Edom, we saw them, right? Those jagged mountains and where the eagles nest up near the stars, and where Sandy and I rode that scary donkey up there and everything. I mean, all of that, he said, that made you feel so invincible. It was kind of a geographic word picture of your arrogance and your pride. He said, I'm going to take you down. I'm going to bring you down, as I will with pride and arrogance all over the world someday. But he said, that's not the whole story. He said, there's another mountain. It's the mountain of Zion. It's the mountain of deliverance. It's the mountain of salvation. And deliverers are going to go up on Mount Zion. You saw them victimized, but I'm going to turn the victims into conquerors and deliverers. That's what he wants to do in your life. That's what he wants to do in mine, to take us as victims and to bring us to deliverance and to actually govern the mountains of Esau. I'm not going to go through all of ancient history and how this prophecy was fulfilled, and it was to the detail. But the fact is, no matter where we've been exploited, no matter where we've been victimized, no matter where people have used us to their own benefit at our expense, no matter how much even we struggle with our own pride, It's the most toxic thing I know spiritually in our lives, our pride. It just makes us feel above people, and I'm not going to get involved, and not going to get my hands dirty there, and that's kind of below me, and well, that person kind of got what they deserved anyway, and thank God, I just, you know, I'm kind of a notch above them, and I didn't get it because I don't deserve it, but they got what they deserved. I mean, the arrogance that makes us feel superior and makes us want to be uninvolved and even makes us want to use people to benefit me only rather than to benefit people, to help them be all that they can be. I mean, when we humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, we defy living like a victim, we defy self-serving, and we say, God, I'm available to you. And the way it can happen is because on the Mount of Zion, he took them down from the heights of their mountains, the Edomites. But I stood there 3 days ago, right where Jesus was crucified, buried, and rose again in the heart of the city of Jerusalem. I stood there 3 days ago, literally, when Sandy and I were there at the end of our Israel tour. And I want to tell you, God has another mountain. It's a mountain of deliverance. It's a mountain of hope. It's a mountain of new start. It's a mountain of old things are passed away and new things have come. It's a mountain of people have walked all over me. I've been so hurt and so victimized, but it's a mountain of deliverance. It's a mountain to say, God, you can do something new in my life. You are the deliverer. You are the victor. You who's going to come and someday even the score is a God of justice. Right now, I'm going to take refuge in you. I can't change other people. All I can do is serve people. And he can deliver your heart to serve people. And he can deliver your heart from the victimization that makes you just want to be so self-protective. And he can bring you to that place of his salvation and his grace. And it's because God has another mountain. It's the mountain of deliverance, where Jesus was nailed to that cross, and where, because of it, Jesus said, take the cup and the bread, like we did earlier in this service, and where there's something of life and a new start for all of us. I'd like you to stand with me.